Welcome to our discussion segment on romanticism. I'm Joe Parker.
And I'm John Streeter.
Let's get started.
We're back.
We are back.
It's welcome
back,
everyone. It's been an exciting month and a half, hasn't it, since we last talked to all of you?
It's like it's a whole new world.
Yeah. I think we predicted, like, no political violence, no new crises around the world, and we were a little bit wrong there.
Yeah, we're absolutely wrong. Yeah, but who's able to predict anything nowadays?
Exactly.
Especially after last year.
Fortunately, though, folks, we are going to continue our trend of kind of trying to stay away from world events and giving you a bit of a respite from the stress of the news. So when you listen to us, we're going to try and give you some cool stories, some uplifting accounts from the past, and some lessons that we can learn from history. That at least is our goal.
Yes, that's our ongoing goal for sure.
Very true.
So, John, I suppose my first question is pretty obvious. Why romanticism? What was a spark and interest for you that you felt like it should have its own episode?
I think it was a natural outgrowth of our discussion of the French Revolution and Napoleon. There's a lot that happened in France and in Europe generally that gave rise to this new movement. And we often see, after periods of great stress and great tragedy in societies, you see kind of a cultural shift occur in the wake of it, usually because of whatever that event was, but also just the general ebb and flow of society and culture. New ideas come to the fore, new technologies change daily life, and this was an example of that.
So as a follow-up to that, was romanticism not around during the wars, or do you think that people just had less time to actually think about it?
It was around. It did. The early romantics were pre-French Revolution, and actually some of them inspired the French Revolution in the shift from logic and reason over to emotionalism and individualism. But after the war, when people did have more time, those who survived, to get involved in cultural movements and more leisure time, you do see a marked increase in the number of people calling themselves romantic in the output of their work, whether it's literary, artistic, whatever. So it overlapped a bit, but it was accelerated by the events in France and in Europe generally during the French Revolution and the Napoleonic Wars.
Okay. So were there different versions of this depending on someone's perspective in tone or a narrative? Does one person talk about something more than another?
Oh, yeah. There's always, I mean, in every artistic or literary or cultural movement, there's going to be differences because we're all unique individuals. But you do see a series of common themes, which I mentioned in the podcast, the emphasis on individualism, a desire to, or a love of nature, and all of those other aspects of romanticism are present, whether you're talking about maybe a French war veteran who has become a painter, or you're talking about a German political revolutionary who's now a nationalist and writing Faust or writing Wilhelm Tell or something like that. They all have these common themes that historians have identified kind of after the fact as this is what romanticism is. Most of the time, the avant-garde in any kind of cultural revolution, they're not working from a set of defined principles. Usually it's after the fact that historians look back and say, okay, these were kind of the things that we notice are broad trends across national borders.
Okay.
It really isn't until the 20th century where people take political programs, boil them down into certain cultural elements, and then impose them on societies. You think of the Cultural Revolution in China or the Nazis, just utter corruption of German culture. Those programs almost never produce any kind of really great culture. They usually end with bodies in the streets.
Yeah.
So it's better to be like romanticism, kind of from the ground up. Individuals
right.
Making their own decisions, pursuing their own interests.
How much did each person who was involved in this influence each other?
It was tremendous. I mean, the people that I talked about, the artists, the writers, the scientists, the musicians, I basically picked them because they were the ones who started these trends in their various disciplines, and then other people built on them. If you think of Alexander von Humboldt, the German scientist, almost every scientist, even to today, credits him with kind of their philosophy of science. We still use Humboldtian science even today. Same thing with Beethoven. I mean, every romantic classical composer all looked back to Beethoven.
It's an interesting thing that there would be a push to this, because thinking about the age of reason and the idea of going to emotion over reason, How did that happen? I mean, were people just, their experiences were so traumatic that that's all they had to work from? Or, I mean, like, why was there a sudden push to that?
That was part of it. A lot of the rationalists who were involved in the Enlightenment, the philosophers and the art and the music and the writings that they created a trend where everything had to be pure reason, pure logic, pure science. And artists, many of them, they will recoil from those kinds of strictures that are placed on what they can create and what is popular in society. So they're going to try to push the boundaries. Artists are famous for wanting to do that throughout human history. And if the limits are science and reason, well, what's the opposite of science and reason? It's romanticism. It's the imagination. It's individualism and things like that.
Is there a case to be made for blending the two?
And that's what should be done. I mean, this goes all the way back to Socrates. Socrates and Aristotle, they both spoke of the balance between emotion and reason, between passion and logic. You do want to have a balance. And I think most of the Romantics understood that. They weren't saying, okay, we're not going to do something that is illogical or that is irrational, but we want our motivations to be a pursuit of individualism, a pursuit of beauty, a pursuit of the romantic in the human psyche rather than the rational. It's not until the early 20th century where we get a group that call themselves the irrationalists, who say that, yes, all the facts are telling me to do this, but I'm going to do that just because I want to. That's when the pendulum swings really far the other way. There's always a swing back and forth between emotion and reason throughout human history, going back and forth between the two.
Right. In terms of the written word, you gave some examples in the podcast of Hugo and Dumas. When I read those specifically as stories because they are, but was the writing style, did that go on to later influence the nationalism that you talk through?
Like, no, not in France. The nationalist writers were really influential in three parts of Europe, in Germany, in Italy, and in Poland, three areas that Napoleon had given their own independent countries and then had it taken away from them at the Congress of Vienna in 1815 after Napoleon's downfall. So writers in France, in Great Britain, and in other more established nations are not going to be as interested in pushing the political agenda of nationalism as they are in simply telling good stories.
Okay.
So if you read Les Mis or if you read The Count of Monte Cristo, there are obviously lessons and they're trying to teach the audience something, but it's not going to be especially relevant to the politics of the day. Yeah. Although now that I... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Well, so the reason why I was asking is sometimes these movements are standalone. They don't have a direct influence on society as a whole, other than people enjoying them and preferring them over older styles. But it seems like this did have an effect on culture to say, or it was reflective of what people were thinking at the time. Mm-hmm. And so were there stories, were there paintings, were there specific things that really influenced that societal shift? Or was the societal shift there first and then the art and science came after that?
I think they happened at the same time. And I want to clarify one thing. Hugo and Dumas and others were very much trying to push political agendas. It was not specifically nationalism. So I may have oversimplified in my previous answer. I'll come back to what you just asked in a minute. But in the revolutions of 1830 and 1848 and the political crises that existed in France during the first half of the 19th century, Hugo and Dumas and others are writing things. I mean, Les Mis is all about street violence, not all about, but it does involve street violence in Paris during the June days. The Count of Monte Cristo does deal with, you know, political themes and stuff like that, but it's not promoting nationalism. Nationalist writing was mainly in Germany, Italy, and Poland. But to your question about which came first, kind of the cultural shift or the writings, I think the cultural shift, it's really tough. I'm trying to separate pre-revolution European history, 1789, the Great Revolution in France, and trying to remember the first ripples of Romanticism existed then. They kind of stopped in terms of artistic expression once the Revolution and the wars broke out because everyone's too focused on surviving the conflicts. So the art did happen, then we get the war, but the broad cultural shifts all happened after Napoleon. So I think it was the art and other world events influencing the cultural shift. But then they started to build on one another. So there's a cultural shift in one place, in one country. Other countries, writers and artists and people see that in one country. They draw on that and they implement cultural shift through their work in their own country. And then it just snowballs from there. Okay. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Earlier this season, we talked about anacyclosis, the cycle of political evolution. In terms of this period, is Romanticism an example of a signal of a shift, or is it the result of a shift?
It is tied to the rising classical liberalism of the 19th century. Not like modern liberalism in any country. Classical liberalism was all about individuality. It was about equality before the law, natural rights, things like that. So you do see a corresponding rise. As a country becomes more romantic, it also becomes more liberal. But Romanticism also fueled certain aspects of the French Revolution, which were not liberal. They were more conservative or more nationalist. And it was liberalism, to your question, that brought about the revolutionary changes going from monarchy or oligarchy to democracy in large numbers of European countries. So culture certainly influences politics. Politics is, to quote Andrew Breitbart, downstream from culture. So you do see the cultural shifts of Romanticism inspire later movements, especially in the second half of the 19th century, where democracy really gets going, even in the more conservative areas of Europe like Germany and Austria-Hungary. But you can't really say that because a cultural shift happens, there's also a shift in politics that leads to, you know, movement on that anacyclosis grid we talked about at the beginning of this season.
Yeah, interesting.
So I don't know if I fully answered your question, but that's the best I got.
It's always interesting to watch the pattern of society and those shifts and try and think, was there a warning that a shift was happening besides the larger events that would occur? Mm-hmm. And I just didn't know if things like this could be counted as, this is a signal that things are shifting or have shifted and there's change coming.
I think anytime there's a big reaction against innovation, against questioning kind of established cultural trends and norms, that is a signal that a cultural change is happening. We did see that in the like 1750s, 60s, and 70s in the run-up to the French Revolution, where people were saying, okay, you know, about 50 to 100 years, the Enlightenment philosophers have said, this is how we're going to do things. We're going to write, we're going to paint, we're going to sculpt, we're going to do everything as far as cultural expression from a reasoned and from a scientific point of view. If you put in too much religion, can't do that. If you're going to put in too much praise for the monarchy, nope, can't do that. Now, they didn't like lock people up for doing that stuff, but there was a great deal of social opprobrium on artists who said, listen, I have my own ideas, let me express them. No, you can't do that. That's not allowed. That's degenerate. That's dangerous stuff. And anytime you have that level of control, whether legal or social, you're going to get some kind of a reaction. And I think the French Revolution and the Napoleonic Wars were the catalyst that swept away so much of old Europe that with those restrictions either gone or certainly lessened, now we have this new idea fueled by the French ideals of liberty, equality, and brotherhood, especially that first one, liberty. We can do what we want in cultural forms, art, painting, poetry, whatever it is.
Hmm. When you think through this period, who are some of your favorite artists, either in style or product? And when you're thinking through the science of it in your mind, as you have taught this, do you highlight a certain thing, a certain person?
They're the ones that I mentioned in the podcast. In terms of writers, I'm not a huge Victor Hugo fan. I recognize his greatness, but his style is a little, and maybe it's the translations. I don't speak French fluently enough to read classics of French literature. I do like Dumas, and I'm a big fan of Goethe and Schiller. I think their work is really, really excellent.
Okay.
But I emphasize all four of them because they all contributed. I just happen to be more of a Dumas fan than I am a Victor Hugo. Like how I view the Beatles. I appreciate their contributions to music, but not really my style.
I would say I'm opposite. I prefer Hugo.
Do you?
Yeah, over... Because I read The Count, and I saw the movie first and then read the book, and the book...
Don't do that.
Yeah, that was really, really stupid. Yeah. I shouldn't have done that.
I did enjoy Les Mis. That's the only Victor Hugo novel that I really couldn't put down.
I really enjoyed the longer version of that book. It has a lot of pretext that is... I mean, it's just magic. It's unreal.
And have you read Faust by Goethe?
Not in a long time.
Oh, man. That's
not in a long time. So when you said you wouldn't include spoilers, I was kind of like, okay, well, good, because I have to reread it.
Yeah, yeah.
I think I read it in high school. Okay. Back then, it was required reading.
Oh, back in the good old days when kids read
books.
Instead of danced on TikTok.
Yeah.
I'm an old man. Get off my lawn.
I'm older, so.
Well, you're ancient. We don't talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely.
In terms of, because you asked about not just writers. I mean, I love the paintings of Delacroix and especially Turner. I am not a huge fan of art, and it shocks students every year when I say this. If I look at, for example, like a Monet and a Picasso, I recognize the difference in style, but neither of them produce like deep feelings in me or anything like that. I'm not moved by them. I guess I'm just a little bit dead inside. But when I... But Turner's
that,
work,
or you prefer order over.
Well, okay, yeah. But I mean, Monet's very orderly. Yeah. You're right. Picasso, he's a bit
kind of a blending of lines, kind of a blurring of lines there. Right?
But Turner's works are just beautiful. His ability to create light with paint is something I've never seen outside of like computer generated stuff that you get in films and things like that. To do all of that, you know, while looking at it, or possibly, you know, from memory. I mean, he painted The Fighting Temeraire not while he's looking at the ship, but just from his own memory. And he got some of the details wrong, but man, to be able to do that is very, very impressive. And I do get a lot of joy out of looking at Turner's. I want to get Fighting Temeraire, like a big copy of it framed and put it up somewhere here in my house.
So, stupid question. Is the painting that you're talking about, is that in a Bond film? When
yes,
James
is.
Bond is sitting on the bench and he meets Q.
I think it's in Skyfall,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah. He meets the young Q and he's staring at that old ship.
I mean, it's Great Britain's, it's been voted repeatedly like the, you know, Great Britain's favorite painting. So it's everywhere. It's on 20-pound notes nowadays.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's all over the place. Once we are able to travel again, everyone should go to Great Britain and go to the National Gallery and
see. Yeah, when you can travel anywhere in Great Britain. So I've been trying to think about how to ask this question because it is a little complicated.
Is it awkward? Prurient?
Yeah, it's awkward.
Debasing?
I guess we read in the past about time periods like this, and we have a name for it, a change in style, either as a result of a change in society, or I'll call it a trauma, like a war, or to signal a change that could be happening at some point soon. Do we have this anymore? And I know that as a historian, you don't teach history past what year again? 2001?
So in my world history class, we end with World War II. Okay. That's mainly for time's sake. We don't have time. It's at the end of the year. Everyone's exhausted, so we stop there. And then in U.S. history, I stop actually with the end of the Cold War. Because it's tough for me to be objective about stuff after the Cold War, stuff that I lived through.
So understanding that, do we have these time periods anymore that we can separate the style? And
I mean, after World War II, there was a huge cultural shift and artistic shift that we see.
And I guess I'm meaning it in the last like 10 years. In thinking about all of the different, I'll call it distractions that we have now, is there a chance that the type of genius that we've seen from these type of shifts is currently, temporarily, not present? Do you think there's a siphoning off of skill or attention or
and
is there a possibility, again, this is an abstract thing, but is there a chance that the concentrated group of people who would have been able to contribute to something similar to this are just off doing other things because of like TikTok and Facebook and politics and cable news?
I don't know. I mean, the short answer is, as a historian, it's tough for me to judge the present. I can do it if I put my political hat on, but I'm keeping that in another room for this for the rest of this season.
Yeah, I threw mine away. I don't have one anymore.
Yeah, but I think that it depends on how you define great work. I mean, are we past the age of the great paintings of Delacroix or I forget the guy who painted Napoleon's coronation? I think it was Houel. Are we past that? Yeah, probably. But there are still great works of art that are being created. I think of, because I love movies, I think of like the Lord of the Rings trilogy, 2001 to 2003.
True.
Incredible work of art. What they were able to put on screen with the technology of the time was absolutely stunning. More recent films, not so much, but separate issue. Music has certainly altered. I mean, if you listen to Richard Wagner's The Ring Cycle, it's, I think, 4 hours long, and it is fantastically bad. The latest song from Cardi B is maybe 4 minutes, so it's at least blessedly shorter, though equally, perhaps, as bad. So you have to define greatness and not greatness in terms of cultural output differently based on the time. I think our attention spans have, as you've talked about many times in this podcast, have been shortened thanks to social media and all of the other distractions we have. But I think it's still possible for there to be artistic greatness, even in our world.
Yeah,
I mean, we have access to the sum of human knowledge. And there
we
are
make
still
cat memes.
Well, okay. Yeah. But what I'm trying to say is, yes, there's a lot of reboots. Yes, there's a lot of derivative work in literature, but there is still greatness. I mean, I've talked to you routinely about The Expanse, which you haven't watched yet, increasing irritation.
That is an example of great science fiction. And just to be clear, I'm not saying that it doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
What I was asking specifically was, does the volume of work that would have been produced had we not had these distractions at the present mm-hmm. be possible? Or you think that
I
there
think
would
so.
Be? Yeah.
And I think it's easier to spread it more widely. I mean, the Romantic movement took like 80 years to spread across yeah. the
and
world.
I think now, that's a key point.
Yeah. It's like, now we can do it in 3 seconds with
yeah,
a tweet.
I mean, even hearing in this podcast, it would be easy to think that this all happened at once. Even
yeah.
though you name years, as you're hearing this in the car or at home, you think that there was this period of time that was somewhat short. And it wasn't short. It
yeah.
was a long time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, even after the Romantic movement kind of ended in Europe, it was still going on in the United States. It was going on in Latin America and in the Southeast in Australia. The Australian Romantic movement is incredible.
Yeah.
It has nothing to do with kangaroos, but, you know.
Is there a danger in us embracing mediocrity in this present time when we look back on these periods and we look at, okay, look at what we're creating now, where everyone who creates anything is a genius and you're brave and you're awesome. And no matter what you do, you're a winner. I'm not saying that's true with everybody. Not everybody says that. And as I said, there are a bunch of people who still work really hard
yeah.
and do great work. But is there a chance that we're settling nowadays in comparison to these type of periods?
It's possible, but it's also possible that because our society has, and I mean not just American, but certainly Western and to a greater extent all of humanity, because of technology, because of the internet, because we are more connected than ever, but also more disconnected, we have embraced individualism to such a degree that it's almost impossible to define what good art is.
Hmm.
So go back to our favorite whipping boy, Star Wars. The number of students who are horrified when I say that I did not like the sequel trilogy, it stuns them. A majority of my students are like, how could you not like? Because they view greatness in film differently than I do because of their experiences, because of their upbringing and their age. But also because everyone on Twitter that they follow and everyone on Instagram or TikTok or whatever social media app the kids are using these days, they all love it. The people that I follow on the few social media apps that I still have that have not been shut down, we don't like it. We're siloing ourselves culturally off from each other. And that's, I think, the biggest danger of talking about just general human culture right now is the danger of walling ourselves off from people who have different ideas. Political ideas, cultural ideas, literary opinions about like what kind of comics are funny. I mean, I follow a couple of pages on Facebook about Calvin and Hobbes. It would astonish. I love Calvin and Hobbes. Always have.
Yeah,
always
I do
will.
Too.
Thank you, Dad, for introducing those to me in the late 80s. But like you get people who would have serious arguments about the value of Calvin and Hobbes. And they're like, well, if you disagree with me, you are clearly a fascist or a racist. Or they start throwing political terms. And so what happens? The admin just blocks them. It goes back to something that's been a constant theme in this season, and that's conversation, being able to talk to people with whom you disagree. So if you want to create genuinely great art, we have to be able to talk to people about what great is. Not everyone enjoyed Faust. Not everyone enjoyed,
Frankenstein.
Yeah, not everyone appreciated Frankenstein. Not everyone liked the paintings of Turner or Delacroix or anyone else. But they became great because scholars and everyday people had conversations and were like, yep, this is great. I don't know, not to pick on Great Britain, but I wonder if you took this poll again, the poll in 10 years, what's the favorite painting? Would Turner's The Fighting Temeraire still win? Or would there be such a divide and no painting gets a majority? You have 10% who love this, 10% love that, 5% love this, 5% say art is white supremacist and a legacy of neocolonialism.
Right.
Can we even know what is truly great anymore? The message of Romanticism is not just, you know, it's possible to have individual liberty when it comes to the creation of art and good culture, but also we have to talk to each other about what constitutes good culture, and that is a way that we can kind of progress as a society culturally. Again, not talking about politics in any of this, although it's true we need to have political conversations as well.
We absolutely do.
We need to be able to talk with one another, to discuss and have conversations, not disagreements, not arguments, not debates, but just, hey, what do you think of this painting?
And it's
what
okay.
What do you think of that painting?
And
you disagree?
Yeah.
You're clearly a bad person. No, that we can't have that.
It's okay for us to talk about these things without deciding, okay, not only are you wrong because I'm right, but you're evil and you have all these other tendencies and habits. It's just like, okay, we don't agree on this. And that's okay. It happens all the time here.
Yeah.
I mean, so.
No, you always agree with me because I am, in fact, always right. Yeah.
Thank you for joining us in our discussion of Romanticism. I'm Joe Parker.
And I'm John Streeter.
Be sure to leave us a review wherever you listen to this podcast. It really does help. Thank you, and see you all next week.